CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story this hour, the U.S. soldier accused of slaughtering 16 Afghan civilians is now being held at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. But many people in Afghanistan want him returned to the country. CNN's Casey Wyan reads from a statement put out by Staff Sergeant Robert Bale's defense team.
Public reports that Sergeant Bale's supervisors, family, and friends describe him as a level-headed, experienced soldier are consistent with information gathered by the defense team. It is too early to determine what factors may have played into this incident, and the defense team looks forward to reviewing the evidence, examining all of Sergeant Bale's medical and personnel records, and interviewing witnesses.
The U.S. Embassy is not confirming an American teacher was killed in Yemen, but they are investigating. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula claims it killed the man as he was on his way to work. Yemen's government says it killed 14 suspected militants today in an assault in the southern part of the country. The Syrian American Council held a rally outside the White House.
Free, free Syria!
Free, free Syria!
Free, free Syria!
They want the U.S. to put more pressure on the Syrian regime to stop the violence in the country. Puerto Rico is holding its Republican presidential primary today. Citizen Jane's Patricia Murphy tells us who she thinks will win.
Rick Santorum had a little bit of a controversy saying that English should be the main language of Puerto Rico. It's obviously a bilingual territory, so it looks like he hurt himself in the process, but looks like it's going to be a Romney day.
The next major contest will be in Illinois Tuesday. Gas prices are up for the ninth straight day. AAA says the national average is now $3.84 a gallon, but prices are already well over $4 in a number of cities. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Listen, if you're considering buying hardwood flooring, don't do anything until you've written down this number and received your free Lumber Liquidators catalog.
With an unbeatable price tag.
Call in the next 10 minutes to get your free catalog.
What I bought at Lumber Liquidators is a vastly higher quality than flooring I had installed 6 years ago, and for a fraction of the cost.
So if you want grade hardwood flooring at unbeatable prices, trust Lumber Liquidators. We buy direct from the mills. Call right now to get our flooring guide and catalog absolutely free. It's filled with top quality hardwood flooring, including solid hardwoods, laminates, and bamboos, and even Bellawood prefinished flooring with a 100-year transferable warranty. The same floor Bob Vila has in his home. This free catalog is full of tips, ideas, and our flooring project list to make your buying decisions easy. Hurry, call right now to get a copy of this free guide and catalog. Call 800-690-9490 to get your free copy now. 800-690-9490. 800-690-9490.
My advice to you, until they upgrade the system, simply turn off PhotoStream on your iPhone the next time you're in Vegas, and then it doesn't go anywhere.
Okay.
Or else, change your Vegas behavior, or else, don't take pictures while you're in Vegas. So now, once you've deleted all the photos in the PhotoStream, you've got to then go to the camera roll and delete those individuals.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. Can I help you?
Yeah, I've been learning about HD radio technology at HDradio.com, and I'd like to see what kind of HD radio receivers are available.
Easy answer. Here at Best Buy, we sell all kinds of HD radio receivers. Home, portables, car, boom boxes with iPod docking.
Cool. Are they expensive?
Nope. This Insignia portable HD radio player is only $49.99, and there's no subscription to listen to HD radio stations.
Sweet. Let's get started.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
I need some answers. September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, and we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Andy Cantor, president of Ridgeview Glass, Cindy Clare, president of Kettler Management, Ron Packard, founder and CEO of K-12, and Richard Johnson, president of Parenteral Drug Association, or PDA. I think I'll stick to PDA. It's our thrill to introduce to you our first guest. His name is Andy Cantor. Andy is the president of Ridgeview Glass. So welcome to the show, Andy. And tell us, what is Ridgeview Glass?
Ridgeview Glass is a glass and aluminum company that specializes in the design, engineering, fabrication, and installation of glass and aluminum wall systems for commercial office space.
So what's the big deal about glass? I mean, glass is glass. A window is a window, right?
Not necessarily. There's a lot of technology that's out in the industry. Things ever since like 9/11, the blast requirements. Glass now takes on a lot of different properties, and there's a lot of specialized engineering and thought process going into it. Although there's other technologies involved prior to that, that's been the big thing in the last 10-11 years.
To tell us a little bit more about the blast glass, or whatever it's really called, what kind of a blast can it withstand, et cetera?
Well, there's all types of levels, and there's consultants that measure the levels, and they set up specs and parameters, and we're there to design an engineer that we're then look at the glass thicknesses, the composition, the attachments to the structure around the building to conform that. If you're dealing with little things from, like, say, a 1 PSI blast up to, say, 40 PSI, you're dealing with different pressures and has to do with setbacks and bomb distance. It's pretty technical.
Well, it sounds technical. Can you maybe put it in terms that the average person like myself might understand? What sort of a blast or what sort of a bomb would this glass withstand?
Well, I don't the bomb side, I don't know much about bomb technology itself, but the blast ratings, they measure them in, like I said, PSI.
Yeah.
So you're looking at, say, setbacks, the distance from where the bomb blows off.
Yes.
So if you think about, say, Oklahoma City.
Yes, yes.
That's something everyone understands. Oklahoma City, you're going to look at how far the truck is that had, I believe, that was some kind of fertilizer, nitrogen kind of bomb. And you look at the distance, the amount of force, and you're dealing with the amount of PSI that's hitting that surface of the glass and the extrusions.
Yes.
And that the composition of design and the way that your attachments.
Did Oklahoma City have that type of glass? That would
No.
So there was no technology at that time.
No, and even after that, people didn't really pay much attention, not till 9/11. That was the turning point.
Wow. So you're doing extremely important work, in other words.
Yes, sir. There's some very very interesting buildings.
Do you have a technological background that got you into this business?
Well, seeing that there was really no one doing any of that, per se, except for some embassy work up until 9/11, no, you're thrown in to learn on the fly. So you have to read and educate and teach yourself. Primarily.
Yeah. How big or small is Ridgeview Glass?
I just say it's a typical subcontractor, and our peak, 150 employees.
Yeah. And you said in the green room that you were founded in 1981 in the basement, but incorporated in 1982. What does that mean?
My father, being the typical person starting a business, left his place of employment and opened up Ridgeview Glass. We lived in a community called Ridgeview. Boom. Hence Ridgeview Glass. Did it in the basement. Started up a small business. And in 82, we incorporated and opened up into a small warehouse.
Yeah. So your dad was a business mastermind and an entrepreneur?
He was an entrepreneur. I don't know about the mastermind on the business side. He was an amazing field technician. He was not a planner or a, per se, business person. That was not his specialty. But when it came to the field and the actual operations in the field, he was amazing.
Well, How did you get involved in the business?
As a son growing up by myself, just like my brother, we both worked the weekends, summer times, cutting glass. When you're 12, 13 years old, you're just involved. You know, you look up to your dad. He's, you know, one of your heroes.
When you were 12 years old, was that the love of your life at the time, cutting glass?
No, playing music.
Playing guitar. Just kind of fooling around with it?
At that point, 12, you're learning, and you know, you're being into music. It's a child thing, and it just, I never, it's a passion I never let go of, and started playing nightclubs when I was 16.
At 16?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Tell us more about that.
It's kind of led to a lot of things. Band now has a CD coming out, working with labels, travel around a bit to play out. We're consistently working, and it's kind of a passion that we're trying to make into a real business.
You're, I think, underestimating it slightly here in your explanation. Tell us about, well, what's the name of the band?
The band's Chopper Trike Rebels. It's a aggressive metal band with a slight death metal influence. Very interesting stuff. Very different than my day job.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is typically what business owners of glass companies do in their off hours.
Well, I'm glad it's not. I don't want that kind of competition. We're too competitive right now in our industry.
Tell us about, is it Gothenburg, Sweden?
Gothenburg, Sweden.
Okay, tell us about that. What is it and where is it?
Gothenburg, Sweden is the second largest city in Sweden. It's a very interesting scene for heavy metal, and a friend of mine plays in a big band.
What does that mean, interesting scene?
It's a very, very big heavy metal scene when you go to Gothenburg. It's almost like the 80s or 90s were here in the States. A lot of long hair, a lot of the things you saw 20, 30 years ago in this country.
And you were doing what there?
Playing guitar with a buddy of mine's band. He's one of the bigger guitar players, not the biggest, though. Technical guitar player in, say, Europe and the Far East, and I got to step in and play.
Step in and play, step into...
An outdoor event in Gothenburg in the countryside. Right outside of the city of Gothenburg, Matthias Eklund's his name, Ia, and got to step in and play guitar.
Is it like a family reunion or a little picnic or something?
No. It was a regular outdoor concert thing. I don't know the numbers of people, but it was you're like an arena type of thing.
Wow. So what was it like playing in front of that kind of a crowd?
Awesome. I mean, you're living. It's a dream. You're as a kid growing up playing clubs. You're always looking to establish and get as far as you can, and then you never nervous. I haven't been nervous playing out in front of people in a long time. But you're looking out and you're seeing just masses of people. It's a pretty powerful feeling.
What's the linkage between your glass business and the band?
Well, the glass business has influenced my band. It's made the band more of a business as opposed to the band affecting my business. The band has become much like Ridgeview, run in a very professional manner. We have fee number, federal ID. We're an LLC. We've got legal papers drawn up. We're negotiating a record contract. We've got a CD coming out. So we've got a lot of the aspects of business through the band, and Ridgeview's been the biggest influence in taking that to a quote-unquote business level.
Yeah. One of the differences, of course, between Ridgeview and the band is that your dad didn't found the band and then pass it along to you or you assume control.
Correct.
Tell us about that transition in the business between you and your dad.
My father, as I said earlier, was a great technician in the field. He was not an organized business manager, so sometimes it could be chaotic in the mornings. Not a lot of planning and thought went into the day's activities, except for the men that were already straight to job sites, so the daily service trucks, the small jobs. There was chaos, more or less, and I was more of a planner. And there was a little bit of push back and forth when there was a transference of power of at least the management side, but it made sense, and through the course of a few years, I assumed more control, and my father backed off on the reins. Yeah. And it was a very peaceful transference, even though there was, I guess, some tension at times, but it was never a horrible, fighting, nasty. You didn't go home with any problems.
I'm going to ask you about two aha moments. So tell us, number one, what was the aha moment when you knew you were going to go into the business and not initially make music the full-time goal?
I was in L.A. In 92 for an event called Foundations Forum, and a buddy of mine was playing bass for a major signed band, Fear Factory. And when I was visiting him, he's sleeping in the back of his car, and the singer for that band at the time was living in a roach-infested hotel. And I just looked around and said, I'm 24 years old. I'm not living like this. I want more for my life. Even though I wanted to make it musically, I had a better opportunity at Ridgeview to actually achieve my financial goals.
Right.
And that was kind of the epiphany, if you will, of the moment in time.
The second aha or epiphany, when both you and your father realized that the transition of running the company to you was a good thing for everyone.
You know, with that, I think for him, I don't think it was any moment. It transferred over time. He, as the company was growing, our wages as family members were increasing. And when you see that on your W-2, I mean, that's kind of pretty, self-explanatory. You see your numbers going up, the volume, the profitability.
You also mentioned, though, hearing comments from customers and from colleagues. Tell us about that.
Well, my father, being born in 35, was the old school gentleman that wasn't the I love you guy growing up, which my mom taught him to be that way he is now. But at the time, he was never one that would pat you on the back and tell you how great you were doing, but he would tell everyone else. So you would hear it from customers or suppliers, other people that I got to know while I was doing business with. They'd, well, your dad was in here today, and man, he's just in love with you. He's saying all this about you, your brother, and various things. And it's nice to hear that, but I didn't per se hear it from him. Wow. Not till much, much later in life.
That's awesome. Could you give us the web address, please, for the band? And then for Ridgeview Glass.
The band is www.choppertrikerebels.com. That'll be up in about 2 weeks, being developed in the UK now. Ridgeview Glass is www.ridgeviewglass.com.
Just how it sounds, R-I-D-G-E, view, glass.
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. We have been speaking with Andy Cantor, president of Ridgeview Glass. And tell us the band's name again.
Chopper Trike Rebels.
Chopper Trike Rebels. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Andy. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Lisa Norell.
And Lisa, who are you with?
My company is Energize Growth.
Tell us about Energize Growth.
Mike, we help business-to-business companies grow market share by growing employee and customer mind share. We're celebrating our 10-year anniversary, and over those 10 years, companies like Adobe Systems, Microsoft, and Wells Fargo have implemented our tools and systems.
But you're here to talk about something else today, actually a very special event on March 22nd.
Yes. On March 22nd, I will be the featured speaker and author at the Tower Club. And it's from 8 to 9:30 in the morning. My session is called Four Strategies to Energize Growth and Thrive in the Recovery. And I'm inviting listeners to check it out and join us.
Why is the topic important for people to come and listen?
Well, in the past, Mike, your company could survive with a pulse. But today, you can only thrive if you have a plan, especially a customer-focused plan that is really, really focused on helping you build a solid marketing platform for growth.
Who should attend this event?
These are business-to-business companies who are growing and are probably successful, but they may have hit that wall and said, we're not sure how to scale the next wall of growth. We need some fresh ideas, so we're going to have three key things we're going to make sure that people walk away with. Number one, fresh new marketing ideas. Two, capitalizing on hidden opportunities. And three, foster innovative thinking with customers' involvement.
What's the web address, please, Lisa?
They can register for the session by calling Kelsey at the Tower Club, which is area code 703-761-4250, or you can go to my website, energizegrowth.com, and just contact me and I'll send you the details.
We've been speaking with Lisa Norell of Energize Growth, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we are thrilled to introduce to you our next guest, Her name is Cindy Clare. Cindy's the president of Kettler Management. So, Cindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what is Kettler Management?
Kettler Management is an apartment management firm located in McLean, Virginia. We manage about 19,000 apartment homes from New Jersey to North Carolina. The vast majority of them are in Northern Virginia, Maryland, and D.C.
Can you give us an example of a local apartment community that you manage?
Sure. We manage a high-rise community called the Millennium at Metropolitan Park, and we also manage a property that's affordable housing called Springfield Crossing.
So from one level to the next, in other words, it runs the gamut.
Correct. We run the gamut from affordable housing all the way to very high-end luxury.
How long has Kettler Management been in existence?
We've been in existence over 20 years.
So I'm guessing running an apartment community is pretty humdrum and mundane, you know, kind of same thing every day?
No, it's different every single day. There's always something interesting going on.
Can you give us an example?
One of the best stories I can give you is I had a regional property manager that worked for me. Had just moved into one of our apartment communities, and she called me one morning and said, I'm going to be a little late, and I have a really good reason. I'll explain when I get in. And she was telling me that she had moved into the apartment, and her cat was acting a little strange, but she thought it was just getting used to the apartment. But that morning she had gotten up, and she'd gone into the kitchen to make her coffee before she got in the shower, and as she went to switch the water on, a snake was coming out of the sink. Needless to say, shocked her a little bit. She doesn't like snakes, so she ran with her cell phone into the bathroom, called maintenance, and didn't leave the bathroom until maintenance, and then ultimately animal control came to take the snake away. And what really had happened was, we don't allow snakes in our buildings, but some people bring things in that they're not supposed to, and the snake had gotten out from the previous resident and was probably crawling around in the ductwork and the pipes, which is what they tend to do, and decided to make an appearance that morning.
So every day is indeed a little bit different.
Every day is indeed a little bit different.
Well, where are you from?
Well, I say I'm from Virginia, but my father was in the military, so I moved up until I went to high school, and I was born in Germany.
Yeah. Our previous guest moved around a lot also. What was the effect of that, or what was your experience of that in your life?
As an adult, you recognize that it makes you a much more flexible and adaptable person, but it also makes you comfortable with all types of people because you've experienced that your entire life. As a child, it was very difficult. I was shy, and I did not like having to be the new kid.
You do not seem shy at all. You were shy as a child.
I was very shy as a child, and you're right. Most people would say, are you kidding?
So shy, how so? Well, what did that look like in you?
What it looked like in me was I was the oldest of four children, and my siblings would meet kids, and then I would kind of tag along and meet people at that point. But I was not one to get out there and introduce myself and jump right in. I hung back. I would have rather put my nose in a book.
Well, you mentioned that the flip point, perhaps, was when you went to college, and why?
Well, when I went to college, I wasn't the new kid anymore. When I went to college, everybody was a freshman in college, and everybody was brand new. And that was a new experience for me. I had always been the new kid. And so it was nice to go in and be able to be just like everybody else.
When, though, did you change? And your shyness or non-shyness was not dependent on circumstances anymore. That was just who you are now.
Right. I would say that evolved as I became more confident, as I went through college and I had close friends and became comfortable in the environment and then moved into the working world. That's probably when it happened, as it evolved from college into the working world.
Are your siblings surprised?
I don't think so. My siblings would have told you I was bossy. They wouldn't have thought of me as shy. They were used to me being the one that when my mother wasn't home, I was the one in charge.
I'm just curious. Growing up, did anyone think that you'd be the president of a company someday?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because I was the quiet one. I mean, I was always did well in school, and I think people would have told you I was bright, but I don't think they would have seen me being the leader, so to speak.
When did you start seeing yourself as the leader?
It took a while. I went from working at my first job to being a vice president at my second job, and I was at my first job for 10 years. And it probably took me a year or two in my job as a vice president to realize, wow, I was in charge and that people were listening to me.
How did that feel?
A little scary. but also very rewarding, because what you recognize is when you're the leader, you're responsible, and you're holding people's futures in your hand in many ways. And so that is the scary part. The rewarding part of that is that you really can make a difference, and you can help people both in the apartment industry, in their homes, and then in their careers.
What did Kettler see in you that made them make you the CEO or the president?
I think what Kettler saw in me was an emphasis on people, which in the apartment business is very important, not only from the resident standpoint, but from the employee standpoint, because the apartment industry is a very labor-intensive industry. I think it was also my focus on training and making sure that we do things the right way, and that we get things done, and we keep the properties running well.
What are the successful criteria that they look for in their industry? In some companies it's just revenue, but yours seems more complex than that.
Well, clearly revenue, and particularly in today's world, because there's so many institutional investors in the apartment management industry. But it's also, in order to have that revenue, you have to have high occupancy, which means you have to have happy residents, which also means you have to have happy employees, because they are the ones taking care of the residents.
What you're doing now is a far cry from the Foreign Service, though, isn't it?
Yes. It's a very far cry from the Foreign Service. I majored in international relations when I was in college, and I thought I would go into the Foreign Service. But I was a little naive and didn't realize that you would have to go rough it, so to speak, maybe in a country that didn't have running water or electricity. So I had to rethink my career. And I was temping, quote unquote, while I was looking for a real job. And my first temp job was at a property management company, and they offered me a job, and here I am.
You mentioned you had to rethink your career, and a lot of people now are facing that. What helped you get the new view of what Cindy should be or could be?
Well, the first step was I had to have a job, you know. So I took a job, and when I took that job, I realized that that it was interesting and that I liked what I was doing. And so I asked, well, what do I need to do to move up in the organization? And then I took those steps. And for me, the key to that is education. You always have to continue to learn about your craft. And the more you do that, the better you become at it.
You said something really profound. You asked what you need to do to move up. And so many people, I think, are afraid to do that, or they just don't perceive it, do you think?
I think that sometimes people, one, expect that you're going to know, and you can't rely on people knowing what you want. You really do have to tell them. And two, there's an expectation, I think, sometimes that, well, I'll show up for work and you're going to promote me. And that's not necessarily how it works.
You had a goal of being in the Foreign Service, and that did not happen. Any regrets?
None.
Why?
Because I love what I do. And I think the important thing about moving up in a career is you have to love it. You have to be passionate about it. If you want to succeed, you have to want to get up every day and do it. It doesn't mean that every day is going to be great. It doesn't mean there aren't going to be days where you think, what am I doing? But you have to love what you do.
You gave this word picture sort of metamorphosis of an apartment community that started with a hole in the ground. Those were your words. You said this in the green room. Well, walk us through that again. It starts with a hole in the ground.
So if you're involved in a building from beginning to end, you literally work with the floor plans, the design, the architects, and looking at the building. And then they take those plans and they literally dig a hole in the ground and start building an apartment community. And you get to watch that building go up. You get to walk those units when they're just framed, and then when there's drywall. And then when the building is complete, it's your job to fill it up. And then when that building is full, it's your job to keep it full and maintain it. So there's a real tangible accomplishment that you get to see.
Well, you're a young woman. Where do you want to take Kettler Management?
Well, thank you very much. I'm not that young, but I appreciate that.
She looks young.
Yes.
I would love to continue to grow Kettler Management. We've grown a lot in the last few years. We've expanded into new markets, into North Carolina and New Jersey. And I'd like to see that growth continue.
What's the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
We had this conversation in the green room, and the first thing that popped into my head was giving birth. And I laughed, and somebody said, well, raising them is harder. And I said, that's very true. But I think that it's that fear of the unknown when you leap into something new, whether that's giving birth or even going to a new job, it's not being in control initially.
So how do you deal with that?
You find ways to take control, and it doesn't mean particularly when you go into a new job, you don't go in and say, I know everything and we're going to do it this way. You listen and you learn. Again, for me, it's all about learning. You really have to be able to listen and understand what works for other people.
That which you are most proud of is what?
My son.
How so?
Because I think one of your greatest accomplishments, at least for me, is being a parent. And what I hope he has learned from both my husband and I is that if you work hard and you set your mind to do something, you can do it. And that we've imparted those values into him, and that he will continue to be successful because he's the legacy we leave behind.
What's his name?
Jack.
Fantastic. Would you give us the web address for Kettler Management?
Sure. It's www.kettler.com.
Would you spell Kettler, please?
Sure. K-E-T-T-L-E-R.
Great. We've been speaking with Cindy Clare. Cindy is the president of Kettler Management. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is...
My name's Paul Smith.
And Paul, who are you with?
I am a benefits consultant with the Potomac Companies.
What does the Potomac Companies do?
Well, we help our client partners control the future costs of their health care.
What do you mean by future costs?
Well, you know, as time, every business executive, one of their top functions in any company, as either an owner or a top executive, is to control costs at their company. Well, healthcare is no different. You have to look at these things. You have to do things to control these costs.
Yeah. Well, why are you guys so good at doing it?
Well, what we've done and what our clients have been telling us is, as we look at the trends, over a 5 to 7 year period, a given company might see their rates doubling. And what a lot of executives don't realize is that doubling, if they're, let's say they're paying $1 million a year for premium, goes to $2 million, but they're going to spend $3.5 million to get there. So it's not just a linear thing, it's more of a exponential thing.
I hear many business owners say that rising health care costs are a fait accompli. There's just nothing they can do about it. Is that true?
Well, that's why they'd want to work with us and find out. There are things that can be done. There's a lot of things that you have to do. There's a lot of information out there, and that's what we help them do.
In just a few words, is there a success story that you can share with us?
Well, it's an ongoing thing. It's savings over time. There's nothing that anyone's going to do as a shotgun approach and go bang and drop your rates significantly and keep them there. It's what are you doing? How are you monitoring? How are you looking at everything?
If someone wanted to contact you and learn more, what would they do?
www.potomacco.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Paul Smith. Paul's with the Potomac Companies. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we are thrilled to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Richard Johnson. Richard is the president of the Parenteral Drug Association, otherwise known as PDA. So, Richard, welcome to the show, and tell us, what is PDA?
PDA, thank you for the opportunity to be here. PDA is an individual membership organization of scientists and regulators that are involved in providing safe and effective injectable products to patients worldwide.
What does parenteral mean?
Parenteral means, literally from the Greek, it means not oral, but in practice it means drugs that are administered via injection.
Perfect. And the PDA has been in existence for how long?
PDA is going to be celebrating our 66th anniversary. We started out in New York City and about 20 years ago moved our headquarters to Bethesda.
And how big or small?
We've got about 10,000 members worldwide.
Yeah. The average person is better off how, by what PDA does?
Almost all of us have had an exposure to a pharmaceutical product, a vaccine, or an IV, especially if we've had
any kind of surgery or life-threatening situations, most of those products are injectable products, and all of them, every single dosage is required to be not only effective but safe, which also means sterile.
How did you get into the industry?
I started out in university as a biologist. A small company nearby was looking for a microbiologist. I started there, and 30-plus years later, here I am. So.
You kind of downplay that a little bit. In the green room, you said, and I quote, "This is a dream come true," end quote. What does that mean?
Over my career, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of different roles in the pharmaceutical industry. I've been involved in developing new products, the quality control of products, and also building facilities around the world. So this is a perfect position because it allows me to apply all of those experiences and all of those things that I've learned over the years to the betterment of my fellow PDA members and to the public at large.
We're moving to international standards, and it's not so easy when you're dealing with companies of various size and companies of various backgrounds and cultural differences. How do you see that moving forward?
I think that increasingly we are in a global environment, and that's certainly true for pharmaceuticals. Regardless of where you are, there's a very good chance that the products that you consume, the injectable products, are not being made locally. But no matter where you are, whether you're in sub-Saharan Africa or whether you're in Europe or the United States, you want those products to be safe and effective. So the science and the technology that allows us to do that really transcends those national boundaries and those language barriers that we have to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, you're doing very, very important work. Thank you for doing it. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Colorado, but my father was in the military. So I think in a sense I've moved around a lot. I lived around the United States and also in Europe.
How many schools before you graduated from high school?
I think I went to 12 schools before I got out of high school. So,
what's that like? For people who haven't moved around like that, what's that like?
I think that as a child, it's not a very desirable thing because you're always the new person in a school. But looking back on it, I can say it has left me with two things. One, you're very close to your family because that's the part that stays consistent with you. And secondly, it gives you a lot of self-confidence and a lot of ability to put yourself in new situations and be comfortable with how you're going to react to that.
Well, let's talk about maybe the challenges first. You moved to Germany. What was one of the challenges moving to Germany?
Well, as a child, just moving to a country that most of the people don't speak your language, where everything from what's on the television to the way things operate is different. That's a little bit scary as a child, but once you get used to it, once you adapt to it, it becomes a really valuable experience.
How do you adapt to it? How do you adapt to a new culture, different language, different way of life? How do you do that?
Well, your core is your family that is with you, so you're not starting out on your own. And you find that despite the differences, there are common things no matter where you go.
How has that helped you in working in international companies and trying to build your organization?
I'm sure that it's given me a much better appreciation of the value of the cultural differences, but still look for those common things that everyone can come together with.
What do you see those common things in drugs and in the pharma industry?
As I said before, I think no matter whether you're from a rich country or a poor country, or whether you're just getting a vaccine to prevent a childhood disease, or you're getting life-threatening surgery, you expect that those drug products that are being injected into you are going to be safe and effective. And regardless of all the other differences that we may have, all of people around the world share that common interest.
Someone in the green room had asked you about bugs. And to talk about the two different types of bugs, if you will, that have been a part of your, career goals.
Okay. Well, when I was in university, I was very interested in aquatic insects. And for those of you that are fly fishermen, you know that aquatic insects are very big in trout fishing. But as it turned out, I ended up moving more into microbiology, which is a mainstay of the pharmaceutical industry. So in the pharma setting, we call bugs microorganisms. In the aquatic entomology, bugs are insects.
So I got to ask you a question about fly fishing. You know, there's this movie, A River Runs Through It. There's something almost, you know, mysterious and mystical about fly fishing to people who've never done it. What's the big deal with fly fishing?
I think fly fishing is so wonderful because it isn't really about catching a fish. There's as much about the art of how you present the fly or you cast. And if you ever catch a fish, the feeling that you get when you do that on a fly rod is so much different than what you get on a standard fishing rig. So if you know, people that do it are passionate about it.
Well, it's interesting because that's almost a process, and PDA is about, our good manufacturing practices. So, I mean, perhaps it's that intellectual discipline for meticulous attention to detail that translates into parenteral drugs.
Well, I'm not sure then whether the chicken or the egg came first. I was certainly fascinated with fly fishing before I got into the pharmaceutical, but I do think that in many careers, having a very clear idea of the process by which you want to achieve something can be a very rewarding part of it, not just getting to the destination.
I'm going to go back to the moving for a moment, growing up. You said that one of the positives of moving so much, 12 different schools before you graduated from high school, is, quote, you were self-contained, end quote. What does that mean?
I think that all of us have to become comfortable within ourselves. And when you are in a situation where you have to constantly be reestablishing yourself with others, that helps if you have a very good self-concept. And so I think all of us hopefully develop that at some point. But when you have to move a lot as a child, you have to develop that earlier.
Did your self-concept at all change when you realized, no, I'm not going to be a career academic. I'm going to be an industry. I'm going to take another job with a microbiology firm. I'm going to be an industry. Did your self-concept change at all?
I think that my self-concept moving from a vision of an academic role to a business role certainly is different. Because I found that, you know, in an academic role, it is to a large extent an individual practice. It's an individual performance. But in an industrial or in a business role, you're very much integrated with a larger team. And so working with teams is a key part of my experience as a professional.
Well, we're starting to see the fruits of monoclonal antibodies and a lot of new biotech products. Where do you see PDA going as these new technologies arise?
PDA has been for a long time has been involved with biotech products, including monoclonal antibodies and even more advanced therapies. One of the things that is common to all biotech products for pharmaceuticals is they're all sterile, and so a lot of the technologies that people have been using to develop and to safely administer pharmaceutical products that are non-biologic are also being applied to biologics.
Well, what legacy would you like to leave as a result of your work with PDA?
I would like to leave an organization that has been around for a long time, that's had a long and storied history of contribution to the industry. I would like to leave that stronger than it was when I came, and with a more global footprint than what it was when I came there.
Richard, would you give us the web address for PDA, please?
You can visit PDA at www.pda.org.
Simple. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Richard Johnson. Richard is the president of the Parenteral Drug Association, otherwise known as PDA. I'd like to thank my co-host Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Richard. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we are pleased to introduce to you our final guest of the day. His name is Ron Packard, founder and CEO of K-12. So, Ron, welcome back to the show, and tell us, what is K-12?
Thank you. K-12 is the largest provider of curriculum, services, and technology to online public schools in the United States, and we now serve over hundreds of thousands of kids using our various products.
Can you give us an example of the tools or the curriculum, for instance?
Sure. We've built every lesson every day in every subject. So literally, we now have over 100,000 students going to school full-time online, where they will have teachers, and they'll go to school online, no different than going to a brick-and-mortar public school. They can do it anywhere, anytime, anyplace.
Well, why would someone want to do that instead of going to brick-and-mortar?
Well, I always joke we have hundreds of thousands of kids and hundreds of thousands of different reasons, but essentially the way to think about it is there's lots of kids who, for some reason, that the brick-and-mortar classroom environment doesn't work for them. It could be highly gifted kids who need to work faster, kids with special needs. Also, you know, we have a very rigorous education that may suit the family's needs more than what the school down the street does.
Could you give us an example of perhaps a special needs child that was helped by your curriculum?
Sure. We literally have, you know, probably now more than 10,000 of them. But I had, you know, a particular example in our first year where we received a letter from a parent whose child had, you know, I think severe autism, if I recall, and was told that the child may never read and write. And, you know, literally a few months into the program, her child was reading and writing, and it was, you know, a testimony that how the technology could actually help that mother who had such care and concern for that child and infinite patience could actually, you know, what they could do with the right technology.
Well, what's the secret? What's your secret? How does it work like this?
Well, I think the secret is, you know, we build great stuff. So, you know, you think about reading a textbook, imagine how much more interesting it could be if you could incorporate today's technology. So to be able to integrate a textbook with video and learning games and animation pieces and then combine that, you know, with either a passionate parent or our teachers are incredible that you can get a pretty special learning environment.
In the green room, you also mentioned, quote, replicating a mother's care, end quote. Well, what did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant was in the case of the special needs, you had in that particular case a mother who, you know, loved that child infinitely and had infinite patience. So, you know, you can never find someone who has that same patience and drive as that parent has. So when you have some of these special needs kids and you can give those parents with that kind of, you know, passion and love, the tools, it's amazing what they can achieve.
You founded K-12 when?
April 2000, the first employee came in.
Why?
Well, the founding of K-12 really goes back to my own situation with my daughter. When she was six, I was working with her on her math and just didn't think she was getting enough. And I really didn't know what I'm a math person, I'm a technologist, but I really didn't know what first grade math should be. So I went online and thought I'd just buy what the best schools in the world do and teach it to her myself. And what I found was I couldn't find anything like that. So it just came to me, you know, I can build this. And I think in today's world, you can build a complete school online.
But that requires running a business with academics, I think, and managing a lot of different people with a lot of different skills. How did you manage that? How did you get involved, feel comfortable doing it?
Well, you know, I think necessity is the mother of all invention, but I think it all starts with a passion. And as an entrepreneur, you know, you have to have a passion for something. And for me, I have a passion for, you know, helping children get a better education. And, you know, one of my, you know, business heroes was the founder of Merck, who used to say, you know, whenever we worried about money or profits, we never seemed to do well. But we worried about providing patients with the best medicine. We always seemed to, profits seemed to come later. So since we started the company, the passion is deliver the best thing for children. And if we do that, everything takes care of itself. And I think that's the culture at which K-12 has been built.
You described yourself as an entrepreneur at heart, your words. What does that mean?
To me, it's somebody who, you know, tends to look at the world not the way it is, but the way it should be or has to be. So you tend to think not in terms of problems, but in terms of solutions.
So in what way did the world need to change back in April of 2000?
You know, let me count my ways. But I think, you know, you had education had been relatively unaffected by technology for hundreds of years. I mean, in almost every other industry, technology had completely transformed it. But, you know, one of the presentations I used to give was I used to show a picture of a classroom in 2000 and a picture of a classroom in 1900 and ask people to tell which was which. So you had this whole, you know, large infrastructure that hadn't been affected by it at all. And to me, it had to be, right? The opportunity to be able to deliver a world-class education to anywhere, regardless of location. I mean, it's powerful. I mean, for the first time in history of mankind, you can separate geography from education. And that's powerful. It's game-changing.
So are you a visionary or a genius?
I'm not sure I'm either. I think I'm just a person who has a passion for educating kids and, you know, at least had the drive to figure out how can we do it. But
I understand your passion with your daughter. But you go beyond that. And where did the passion for education in general come from?
Well, you know, I really believe that, you know, what's necessary for society is an educated population. You know, I think if you have an educated population and you have a society with free market principles, it's those are the drivers of economic success. And I think that's been true everywhere. So, you know, I always say I feel like I'm the luckiest man alive because my purpose every day is to help children get a better education and to be able to combine that with the American entrepreneurial dream of, like, building a large company from nothing. I don't know how it would get any better than that.
Did your dad have anything to do with who you are today?
Oh, my dad was, a huge inspiration in my life. And he, he raised me with an attitude that you can do whatever you set your mind to, that nothing is impossible. And, you know, having heard that for, you know, growing up, I think it gives you that, you know, mindset that I can go do this.
When did you start to believe it, or did you always believe it?
You know, I think I always believe it. You know, when you're a kid, you believe everything your father says, and then, you know, you question it, and then you come back to realize how smart he was years later. I'm not sure I ever questioned that. I mean, I was always fascinated, even as early as, you know, middle school. I remember thinking, you know, he worked for large companies most of his life, that it was amazing to me that this large company, at some point, there was one guy. And the idea of creating something significant from just a piece of paper, an idea, it was always fascinating to me, even at that age.
And you had that thought in middle school.
In middle school, I remember thinking that. I remember vividly thinking that when I was looking at my dad's company, thinking, wow, at some point, this was just one person.
Did people at the time think you were a little odd because you were so smart and visionary?
I'm sure if I had shared that with a lot of people, they would definitely have thought odd and I'd be outcast. So I'm not sure, you know, it's the kind of thing I went around telling everybody. But I remember vividly, I remember having that thought at that age.
Where do you want to take K-12?
You know, the nice thing about K-12 is we want to take it everywhere. So, you know, I don't think, you know, my mission is to deliver this kind of education to every child in the globe who wants it. So we're very excited now that we've expanded. You know, we now have schools in the Middle East. We're in the process of acquiring, hopefully acquiring something in China. So it really is a global vision. And what I want to do is, use technology to give kids more of an opportunity. And the idea is you should be able to be whatever you want to be in life. It doesn't matter where you live anymore. And so we want to have every child in the world have that opportunity.
You speak with such a tremendous sense of urgency, yet previously in your career while on Wall Street, you didn't have that same sense of urgency. In fact, you said you were just biding your time. What do you mean by that?
Well, I always felt like even from the time I graduated from college at Berkeley back in, 85, that I worked at McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, but I always felt like I was just biding my time, waiting for what the calling was, that I would be an entrepreneur, I would build a company, but waiting for where I'd see that opportunity and idea and then put everything I had into it. And I was fortunate that it happened.
Well, you went to undergraduate school in Berkeley, and you got an MBA from Chicago, which are probably conflicting, shall we say, environments. How did that happen, and what did you learn from that?
They are different environments, there's no question. And, you know, Berkeley, I loved Berkeley. And I think Berkeley, the things you take out of Berkeley is an incredible belief in, you know, things like, you know, freedom and free thinking and free ideas. And Berkeley, I think, has that. And if you take it in its true form, that's what the whole free speech movement at Berkeley was about. It's about free ideas and not constraining your thinking. I mean, it's gone a little different direction since then. But that's what – so I came out of Berkeley with, a more open mind than I came into it with. And at Chicago, it was a very different environment, but you really, again, I think it's still about freedom, right? Chicago is all about freedom of markets, freedom to pursue your livelihood, freedom to, pursue, what you want to be. So I think they're not as different as people think when you take it to that essence.
This sounds to me like it's just this clear path to this perfect goal. Has this been like that, or has there been bumps in the road, controversy?
That would be the understatement of the century. I think, when you're going down this road, there are large, powerful forces that do not want change in education. They don't want technology in the classrooms necessarily. They don't want online education. And these are very powerful political forces. So over a course of our history, we've had, been sued by various education groups saying online education was illegal. We've had terrible articles written about us that were just, completely misleading and untrue. So you fight this. But to me, they're all blips on the road, right? When you have a higher calling and a mission of what you want to do and you believe it's the right thing, that children should have this opportunity, they just become blips.
How do you know what you are called to do? How does one know that? When was it obvious to you?
I think it becomes obvious when you can't stop thinking about it, right? I mean, it's a 24/7 occupation. You go to bed thinking about it. You wake up thinking about it. You're in the shower thinking about it. You drive a car, you think about it. If you're fortunate enough to find an hour to play golf, you think about it. And when it becomes that all-consuming, it becomes pretty obvious. And when you really believe what you see what you're doing is working, and you get those letters from parents saying how it's changed their kids' lives, all you need is a few letters like that, and then there's no doubt that's what you're called to do and that's what you want to do.
Would you give us the web address for K-12, please, Ron?
www.k12.com, k12.com.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Ron Packard. Ron is the founder and CEO of K-12. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Andy Carter, president of Ridgeview Glass, Cindy Clare, president of Kettler Management, Richard Johnson, president of Parenteral Drug Association, or PDA, and, of course, most recently, Ron Packard, founder and CEO of K-12. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interviews. More than anyone, I'd like to thank you, our guests, our listening audience. Thank you so much for listening to the show. If it were not for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. I'd like to thank the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And this has been your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Again, thank you so very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a
a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.